Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 396. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in thisshowissogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun episode for you this week. Let me introduce our guest. Poyo Del Mar is an award-winning journalist, performer, recording artist, activist, photographer's muse, and so much more. Her podcast, Party Foul Radio with Poyo and Pearl, is a global sensation. It is the Podomatic app's number one LGBT podcast. She was voted San Francisco's most notable drag queen in 2016. She was named the drag queen of all media by the Huffington Post, for which she is a regular contributor, including with a new fiction series on there that we're going to talk all about. She is the producer and MC of the Glamazone, and as an in-demand MC, she has headlined Sacramento Rainbow Festival, Prides in Modesto, San Mateo, and Sacramento, with countless other appearances all over the world, but right now she is here with us. Poyo Del Mar, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, Ken, thank you so much. And God, when you read off all those accolades, it really makes me sound interesting. So thank you for doing that.
I subtracted so many, so there's even more than that.
Oh, well, I would hope there's something of note, because I've been doing this for over a decade, so if I did not have something to put on my resume, it would be really lackluster and disappointing to me at this point in time.
Well, thankfully, we are where we are. Let's just get this piece out of the way. We have to do the small world thing. Poyo Del Mar, a Baldwin-Wallace University graduate.
I, in fact, am. And I, when you first contacted me and you told me your email address and I saw that you were affiliated with BW, I thought that you might have contacted me because you knew that I'd also gone there.
No.
Very small world, Ken. Very.
For our listeners who don't know, I'm also a professor of education at Baldwin Wallace, so a fun connection. But anyway, we have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm always ready.
For folks who tragically, tragically do not know about Poyo Del Mar, how would you go about describing her to folks?
Well, this is how I believe. I've always imagined the character of Poyo Del Mar to be, I was a child of the 80s. I'm 44 years old. So I grew up watching those famous hair metal bands on MTV when MTV actually still played music. Do you remember those days?
I do.
So I describe her as that woman that we would frequently see like rolling around on the front of like a Thunderbird or a Firebird or a Camaro while some, you know, rock band was playing music. And now she's 44 years old, doesn't realize she's actually had five kids, and the clothes that she was wearing in 1988 don't actually flatter her anymore, but she just doesn't care. That's who she is. You know, the prettiest girl in the trailer park. That's how I think of myself.
I love it. I love that it's essentially a Tawny Kitaen shout-out. I love that.
Of course, absolutely. Go, Tawny Kitaen. I love you.
I've never name-checked her on the show in 9 years of doing this, so that was a big moment for all of us.
Yeah, well, I think that probably nobody has name-checked her in the last 30 years, so good for all of us.
What can you tell us about Poyo's first appearance on stage?
Oh, well, the first time I was ever in drag was actually while I was living in Cleveland, and a good friend of mine who still lives there, her name is Nora Goodwin, she worked for Merle Norman, this cosmetics company, and so I decided I was going to do drag, and she painted me, and I looked exactly like her, because as with most makeup artists, she only knew one style of makeup, really. And so I looked exactly like her. But it was years later when Poyo Del Mar was actually born. And I got into drag because I love to raise money for the community and good causes. I find that drag, especially in San Francisco, has a strong affiliation with things of a charitable nature. So I did drag for a cause, you know, and then when you're gorgeous like that, when you feel gorgeous, at least, you don't ever want to take the makeup off, especially since it's your first time. So friends and I went out to a nightclub here, and the MC of the show saw me from the stage, and I was rather, you know, I'm rather tall, especially in drag, and she called out to me and brought me on stage, and even though it was my very first time in drag, she basically, through the audience response, made me one of the stars of her show for the next several years. And while we had never met before that, we became best friends. And unfortunately, I was legitimately with her until the end of her life. So shout out to my dear friend who has departed from us now, Cookie Dough. And thank you so much for all the wonderful opportunities that were presented to me from that.
Amazing. Amazing. And how would you describe the evolution of Pollo Del Mar? I would imagine that in the past 10 years, you are a much different performer than when you started out.
Absolutely. And I think that with, like many people who do drag, I believe that for me, the thrill initially was the being on stage, being present in front of people, the cheering and adulation of an audience. But since then, the evolution for me has come through a growing appreciation for all of the many elements that go into being a drag artist, and that includes makeup. For example, I used to hate doing makeup. Mm-hmm. It was just like the evil means to an end, which was ultimately being on stage. And now I've come to love the art of makeup and all of the elements that go into drag, whether it's coming up with a character or persona or coming up with what I want to wear on stage. All of those things, I think, have become something I really love. I love making props. I love all of these various elements that make drag truly art. You know, more than just the 5 minutes on stage or whatever. In fact, there are many times when I don't even care to do that. I just want to put together all the pieces of the puzzle to make it happen.
Amazing. Amazing. You have this wonderful quote. I have to read this quote for everybody. Quote, when I produce a show, I don't just want audiences to leave saying, I saw Pollo Del Mar perform. I want them to experience who I am as a person. Where do you find that balance between your life in and out of drag? When you're on stage, how much of your life out of drag do you bring up there with you?
One of the things I mean specifically by that quote is that I feel as an entertainer, from the moment I leave my home, the minute that door opens and I step out into the real world, the performance begins. Because drag, in my mind, is not just about glamour and beauty and all of those things we see. It's actually a political statement.
Yeah.
You know, bucking the norms of society. And so the moment I leave my home, the sanctity of where I live and can be whomever I choose within these four walls, when I go out into the real world, I bring with me all of that. And so when I meet my neighbors, for example, I live in a very heterosexual neighborhood and very blue collar. And almost every one of my neighbors within a couple blocks radius has seen me because I've lived here the duration of my drag career. So all of that is an interaction, and I get to shift their perspective, because most days of the week, most interactions, they see me just as that average gay man who walks down the street to get on the bus and go to work or go to wherever I'm going. But that one instance where they see me all done up shifts their perspective, because they think, well, that's that guy that I know. He's a good neighbor. He's a nice person. He treats my dog well when he passes. He says hello. He's friendly. But this also is who he is, you know. So there's that element. But I also believe that drag being performance art means that every interaction that I have with a person in a nightclub is part of that. You know, I want to be perceived as friendly. I want to be nice. But when I go on stage, you know, I really believe that as an MC of a show, more than just a lip sync artist or whatever, I'm not dancing and kicking and all that stuff, Ken. I just can't. I'm too old. I would throw out my back. Drag queens don't have any kind of insurance coverage. There is no such thing as twerkers comp, people. There is not. If I throw out my back or break a hip, girl, I'm laid up for weeks. But, you know, I think that a huge part of who I am goes on stage with me. And as an MC, I have a greater interaction with the audience because I get to share who I am through interactive conversation or dialogue, jokes, things of that nature. And I think that that's a huge part of what I love about performance.
I would like to pause here and announce to our listening audience that we are right this second introducing the This Show Is So Gay insurance plan. I think we have our first enrollee. So this is very exciting. And the premiums are quite affordable.
If the premiums are affordable and there's no such thing as, like, you know, pre-existing conditions, I'm good to go.
Awesome. Because,
yeah.
I love talking about regionality. You know, it's been so much fun having guests from just all over the country, you know, over the course of this show. Talk to me about how much your drag might be different someplace else, or how much San Francisco plays into who you are.
Well, knowing that you are located in Cleveland and that's like your home base, of course, my earliest influences in drag were based in Cleveland.
Yeah.
That's where I came out at 21 or 20 or however old I was. And that's where I was first exposed to drag in the nightclub and nightlife scene. So shout out, major shout out to one of my biggest influences early on, who was Melissa Ross. And I looked her up years later. Listeners around the world, Melissa Ross was certainly at least 25 years ago the biggest name in Cleveland drag. And she was a huge influence on me because I went to her show. It was like a must attend event on Sunday nights at a place called The Cage back then. And so I brought that with me to San Francisco. And of course, it is no accident that my drag show here in San Francisco is on a Sunday night, and that I try to foster that same kind of sense of community that I felt there. But San Francisco drag is very different than what we see in many places. San Francisco was the original home of punk rock drag,
right?
Where drag spans from glamour to gore and horror and whores. And, you know, we've got it all here. And I think that the regionality of San Francisco, unfortunately, is beginning to get watered down, like what I perceive to happen in many places, because when I started this, there was no such thing as RuPaul's Drag Race.
Right.
You know, every place had its own local influences, where whatever drag persona was big in that area kind of dictated what was to come from other people, or what was acceptable or expected from other people in that region. And now, because we all have a lot of the same influences, wherever you go, you'll see 10 girls who look like Raven, or 5 girls who look like Trixie Mattel, or whatever the local influence is. And I think that I, fortunately, because I started drag quite a bit later in life, I started drag when I was in my early 30s, I think that I had already had so many different influences, very few of which came from anything relating to another drag queen. Yes, of course, there were influences from Divine and
sure,
and a few people, you know, whatever. But for me, I think that a lot of it was pop culture based. You know, I mentioned Tawny Kitaen in a joking fashion, but that was she and Anna Nicole Smith and a lot of these other women who I'd grown up thinking were so gorgeous really played an influence. So of course, I suppose that's a lot different than people who might have been even older who had actual classy influences, you know, like, I want to be Marilyn Monroe, or I want to be whatever. I'm like, I want to be trash, and I'm going to do it.
I love it. Well, let's do a little word association with Pollo Del Mar. I'll throw out some concepts out at you, and let's get your reflections back on them and how you feel. Let's start with an easy one. Talk to our listeners about the influence of Mariah Carey.
Well, I think that, first of all, Mariah Carey is my favorite artist of all time. So she's had a huge influence on me. And when I was at Baldwin Wallace, I will tell you, a freshman at Baldwin Wallace in 1991, my roommate Jim Jarrell and I played Mariah Carey's debut and her Emotion CD on a daily basis for hours and hours, to the great, great annoyance of people who lived in our dormitory, because they were playing Metallica on one side. We were over, like, getting our emotions on, you know. And so she, for me, is a huge influence as well, because she is somebody who, through the evolution of her own persona and public personality and all of the things we got to know about her, started off very classy, and now if she's not in a tube top and a pair of coochie cutters, she's just not doing it, you know. So that's how I feel too, because I can do the whole gamut. So for me, that's her influence.
Love it. All right, more word association. Adidas.
Oh my god, you really are. I have 26 pair of Adidas high tops, and most of my wardrobe is somehow affiliated with an Adidas logo. So I love bright, colorful things. And of those high tops, about at least half of them are neon colors. So, yeah, huge influence on me.
All right, one more. I fear that some of our younger listeners only know Linda Carter from, like, Sky High. Talk to our listeners about Linda Carter.
So, listeners, if you only know Linda Carter from Sky High, I'm so sorry that you missed out on the iconic 1970s television series Wonder Woman. And, you know, as a child growing up, actually, just before doing this interview, I locked down an upcoming performance date to be performing as Wonder Woman. I have a custom-made Wonder Woman costume.
Of course you do.
grew up watching Wonder Woman on TV in the pre-cable era, before Netflix, where I had to sit in front of a humongous television set, and I would actually kiss the TV when she came on, and it was like it would make my lips crackle because you could get the static from it.
Yes.
And I was very fortunate because my mother, who is ridiculously beautiful, has a striking resemblance to Linda Carter, especially when she was, they were both very young in the 70s. So one of my most, oh gosh, influential beauty icons for certain.
Love it. Love it. Again, listeners, we are here with Poyo Del Mar, journalist, performer, recording artist, activist, so much more. I have to tell you, I enjoy the podcast so flippin' much. Party Foul Radio. Where did that come from?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, I am so grateful that you and overwhelmingly large number of other people enjoy it. We, a good friend of mine, her name is Pearl Tease, and she's a transgender woman here in San Francisco. She has long time been affiliated with another local radio show. And I have done, you know, I have a degree in broadcasting.
Yes.
From Baldwin Wallace. So I wanted the opportunity to go back into media. I love media of all forms, which I think is what made Huffington Post originally dubbed me the drag queen of all media. I've done television, radio, film, you know, the whole thing. And but I particularly love the opportunity for two people with diverse perspectives and points of view and life experiences to come together and talk. Plus, through having done what I have been doing in terms of drag and media for quite a long time, I've got a huge number of friends who are, I guess people would say, famous or very, at least very successful in whatever their chosen career is. And I wanted the opportunity to bring them together with my friend and talk about subjects of interest to the LGBT community as well as our allies and, you know, anyone who would listen. So we launched it over a year ago when you were doing my introduction and said that you've been doing your show for over 900 episodes.
400.
Oh, sorry.
9 years.
400. That's right. Listeners, look, I'm a drag queen. I'm not very good at that. 400 episodes, 900 episodes, 9 years. I don't even know what day it is. So, but when we, you know, now that we've been doing ours, we are celebrating. This is our 60th episode this week that we'll be recording. And we've had some incredible, quite honestly, life-changing for the two of us conversations on that podcast. So I'm really grateful people around the world tune in and listen. And it's been an overwhelmingly successful experience in ways that we never would have imagined.
Look, I find it to be very entertaining, very professional, but you still maintain when you interview people your appreciation, which I love, for artists that you genuinely have affection for or admire their work. What was one of those interviews where you walked away saying, you know what, that was just a great chat?
First of all, thank you for that. When you're a journalist, I think sometimes you think to yourself, well, I should seem objective in this conversation. And that's one of the things that as a print journalist, I always do. I try to be objective in terms of the way I present the story on the Huffington Post or other publications where it might be located. But in the actual conversation that I have with these people, there is nothing wrong with fangirling if you're going to fangirl.
Yeah.
So, and we frequently pull people in who the audience might not be widely exposed to, but people that either Pearl or I both really enjoy, and as a result of the podcast are able to introduce a new audience member to them. So one of the ones that comes to mind immediately is there's a phenomenal Australian pop singer and pop star who people are beginning to know, and many do know, of course, because she's got millions of views on YouTube. Her name is Betty Hu, and her new album, The Valley, just came out a couple of weeks ago. And in advance of that, we sat down and talked, and it was just her and I. She and I were on the phone together. And by the end of it, I felt like, I said to her even, you know what, I think we could be BFFs. We just really connected. And that, I think, is the best kind of interview. And that, quite honestly, Ken, is how I have gotten to become, you know, earlier it sounded like I was bragging, perhaps, like I happen to know people who are very successful in their chosen industries. But almost always how that started out was me connecting with those people as a fan of their work. And it just so happened that they're good people and we had a great connection. And then over time, something more developed. Another situation that comes to mind immediately, very recently, we had Dustin Lance Black, the Oscar winner for Milk. And, of course, he recently directed When We Rise for ABC and the miniseries that they did. And we had him on, and I happened to have been an extra on a very brief scene in his miniseries, but he was so fun to work with, and I was the only one in drag on the whole set, so of course I got a lot of his attention personally, and we connected as well, and so we maintained contact, but it was just a great conversation.
So important. Again, listeners, if you guys are like, oh, how do we create a successful podcast? The number one word for your little learning annex with Ken and Pollo, it has to be authenticity. And yours really comes across. And I so appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate the fact that we were able to, you know, kind of convey that to our listeners, because one of the things that if people listen, you know, Pearl and I, my co-host, we don't always agree. And it's been a she's quite a bit younger than I am, and sometimes I think that people have to grow into the ability and comfort in having conflict and understanding that conflict or disagreement does not mean that two people don't love each other or don't respect each other. It just means they don't agree.
Right.
And some of my favorite moments on our podcast are when we don't agree and we actually have the ability to talk about that on the air, because it says to people who are listening, like, look, these two people obviously care about each other. They obviously support each other and want the best for each other. They don't see eye to eye, but through having conversations about things that are difficult to talk about, they're actually coming to a closer understanding of where each person's mind is.
Yeah.
And I think that genuine love for one another and the authenticity of our conversations does translate to listeners, and it's changed me, Ken. Like that it has changed me. Maybe it hasn't changed my perspective, but now when I go into life, because I have a better understanding of another person's point of view, I'm able to take that with me into my interactions with strangers and people that I happen to run into or encounter on the streets that may be different than myself. So I love that about our podcast, honestly.
Yeah. Well, that change can't happen putting on my professor's hat unless you're open to it. So kudos to you for being open to hearing those perspectives. It would make the world a better place if we all did that. You've mentioned the Huffington Post. We have to talk about the Huffington Post, and certainly we'll provide the link. Folks can stroll on over to the Huffington Post and see all these different interviews that you've done and your musings and whatnot. But there's this whole new aspect to all of this. I don't know that we normally say, hey, let's go to the Huffington Post for some fiction, but if we were to do that, we would find you right there, Life by the Bay.
Yeah, you know what? First and foremost, my mother, who I mentioned briefly earlier, not only is she gorgeous, but she's also very persistent. And since I was a young man, she has always said, I really think that you will eventually write a book.
Yes.
And that has never really been my focus, because when I was 8 years old, I came home from school, Ken, and told my mom, we read this thing in school about journalism, and that's what I want to be when I grow up. And at 8 years old, and legitimately, what we read was journalism is writing for a newspaper or magazine. It was so brief like that, but it just planted this idea in my head. Well, throughout my life, I've had the opportunity, I've really been blessed to both do incredibly interesting things at times and have had some pretty dark experiences that have shaped who I am as a person. And all of those things start to play out when I sat down to start thinking about what I would want to write. And when we talk about fiction, it's very loosely fictional.
Yeah.
Like, elements of it are, it's almost entirely based on my own life as a person who came to San Francisco when I was 26 years old in 1999. And the character names have been changed. Some of the cities of origin have been changed. The details have been changed. But the vast majority of it's actually authentic and real. Again, which is one of the reasons I think that when people read it, they're like, oh my gosh, I feel like you really were there. And I was like, well, that's because I was really there. But it's, you know, I fell in love with Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. When I first moved to San Francisco, I'd never heard of him prior to arriving here. And as it turned out, I was walking past a garage sale probably 2 weeks after arriving and saw his books available at this garage sale for like 25 cents each. And I bought them and then I read them voraciously. And that experience of reading his work shaped my experience in San Francisco, which is one of the reasons why I think this series plays out so similarly in some capacities to Tales of the City. But it was through that that I realized, you know what, books can be written. They don't have to be a situation where it's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It can just be an anthology series, a serialized piece of short stories that happen to coincide with one another. And that's how this is shaping up. It's a whole series of short stories about my experiences, and hopefully they'll come together at some point to make my mommy happy, and I can be able to publish them as a collective.
I will tell you, it really does make your mom happy when you send out that link and say, here, fine, mom, here's the book, because holy cow, it's a lot of pressure sometimes. I enjoy Ryan immensely. I've read all of these entries, and I find it to be quite immersive, which I just enjoy. It's quite transportive. I love this line. I don't really know why. Maybe this says something about me, but this line, quote, I asked him to set an alarm, Ryan thought. Shoving his feet into a pair of Adidas, he pulled a matching hoodie over his head. And I remember reading that and thinking, well, gosh, that's a lot of pressure for running out in the morning. And there it was.
Yeah, so that's actually from the first installment, and it is, I don't know if my mom listens to this, I don't know how happy she'd be to know, but that's literally how I first spent my first night in San Francisco, waking up in some strange man's bed. But, you know, I don't think that that's really uncommon for a young boy from the Midwest who ends up unexpectedly in gay Mecca, and, you know, it's definitely... I think the experience of moving here, and I think this will come across as the story unfolds, I hope and pray, you know, like, as a writer, that's what I'm hoping I can convey to people who might be reading. It's definitely a situation of Dorothy and Oz, but kind of maybe the R or greater rated, you know, we hear kid in the candy store, but I don't even think that conveys it. You know, it's a child and adult toy store.
Yeah. It's great. And it's relatable for me as a Jersey boy who moved to New York City for college. Trust me, I'm seeing a lot of myself in there as well.
Well, yeah, I think that no matter where you come from, I think that's one of the beautiful things about telling stories that speak authentically to your personal experience, because whether others have perhaps had those exact experiences or not, they can certainly relate to the feelings of either wanting that kind of experience or having had it in their own setting. I mean, it's not very different than, for example, when I initially showed up at Baldwin Wallace. You know, I was 18 years old. It was my first time having real freedom. I was around people my own age, and there were no rules. There was no bedtime. There was nobody to tell me what to eat in the morning, or, you know, even the professors, even though it was strongly encouraged that I show up for class, you know, if I didn't, I didn't. And how I spent my time otherwise was my own doing. And sometimes you make great choices, and sometimes you look back and think, I wish I'd done something different, but it makes a great story later on.
Yeah. And again, if your mom is indeed listening, I want to remind her, he just thought about possibly missing class. No classes were ever missed.
Oh, my mom is, Ken, you can't pull the wool over my mom's eyes. First of all, she's quite intelligent. And second of all, she knows her son very, very well. And She also paid a lot of those bills, so she probably, you know, already is aware of how her money was misspent.
I love it. What is coming up for Pollo Del Mar that we are excited about?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I'm constantly getting great new opportunities. And one of the reasons why I love sharing pieces of my personal life, which I've never had the opportunity to do so much through my writing before, is because not only do I think that San Francisco is a magical city in many ways, but I frequently have said in a semi-delusional way that I feel like there's something magic about me as a person. And I think this can be true of anyone. I think what happens with me is that I manifest things more wholeheartedly through strong passion for them, and some kind of disconnect in my brain that says that if something is so important to me that I can't do it. And what I mean by that is, I make music because I love music, despite the fact that I can't sing, I can't do any of that. So you just do what you love. And as a result of doing what I love and pursuing things that I love, I've got songs that are upcoming this year, which blows my mind, because I get to work with incredible people whose music I've always respected. I love house music, for example, and I love DJs. And I have a number of incredible DJs and music producers, as well as vocalists that I grew up loving their music that I'm going to be working with this year, and that's so exciting. And then on the flip side of that, for example, my most recent foray into living my dream, my friend Heidi Patty in Ocala, Florida, who I went to high school with, always says, buddy, you are living the dream. You're living the dream. And that's really true, because from the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I have loved professional wrestling, for example. And there's a local wrestling organization here that does wrestling. It's called Wrestling for Charity, and they produce wrestling events to raise money for great causes. And they've invited me on board to be working with them in a variety of capacities, not the least of which is a recent foray into actually stepping into a wrestling ring. And if people go look up drag queen brawls with female wrestler on YouTube, and it'll pull up the video. It's absurd, but there's more of that to come. And I really do feel like I'm living a dream.
Oh man, it's inspiring stuff. Listeners, this is what we need you to do right this second. You can follow Pollo Del Mar on Twitter. The handle is TheGlamazonPDM. There is, of course, a Facebook page, Pollo Del Mar Fans, which you can find so easily. Go to anywhere fine podcasts are available. I mean, truly anywhere. Party Foul Radio. So enjoyable. And, of course, over there on the Huffington Post, Life by the Bay. Check out all of those installments. Here's what I have to say about you. Are you super entertaining? Absolutely, of course you are. But you are so unbelievably accessible, which I really think draws in the audiences in a way that a lot of entertainers just don't do. You don't feel like a thing apart. You have all the talent, and you're up there doing what you are clearly so good at and wielding your pen in an incredible way as well. But it all just feels so accessible, and I'm so appreciative that you put that out there.
Gosh, like, that kind of feedback is a little overwhelming in a very positive way. So I appreciate that. I think that, you know, you mentioned that quote earlier when I said that I want them to feel like they've experienced who I am as a person. That's one of the things that I learned, you know, not that long ago in life, but a little over a decade ago. I felt that I grew up thinking that there's certain things you have to hide about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, for me, a huge part of that was being gay for a long time. And then what I recognized is that when you really are authentic in who you are, when you present yourself exactly as you are with as little errors as we can as a human, I think that's innate in us that we want to present in a positive way, at least, that the things that we feel often set us apart from other people actually are what pull us closer to one another. And when you are genuine with what you're feeling, it allows people the permission to feel those things themselves. Or when you come across as not always having it all together, or when you present the fact that life is full of wonderful things, but there's also some really difficult challenges, and you are open about feeling those, people feel connected to you because you feel real. I think that in our society, so often we are presented only the Hollywood version of a person. For example, like, they're beautiful 24 hours a day,
right,
or they are confident and they are successful and they are all of these things that we aspire to be, but don't always feel. And then sometimes we feel shame for not being that. When you just come across as a person who is like, you guys, look, you know, I go to the bathroom the same way you do, or whatever, I think that those things make people appreciate you in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. And I know a lot of artists that I love what they produce and what we see publicly from them, whether it's their music or their acting or their writing, but I don't feel like I know them. And I think that one of the biggest blessings that the biggest blessing that drag has given me is that it has allowed me an opportunity to connect with and build a community of people around me that I would have never had a chance to meet or never had a chance to impact or interact with without it. And I love that. And through a lot of my social media, Ken, one of the things that has continually blown me away is that people will come to, for example, my Facebook page because they like drag queens. Then they realize maybe they like me. And then through interacting on those social media platforms, they begin to meet other people who are like-minded, and there are people from around the world who know each other on a first-name basis. They've never met, but they've interacted on social media through me in some capacity, and now they are part of each other's social network, and I'm continually blown away by that. How, for example, I do makeup live on Facebook occasionally, and by occasionally, I mean every single week, but the people who come in to watch that came because they like drag and they like makeup. And then through the interactions, for example, there's a woman who a few weeks ago was so concerned, and she shared this publicly in an open forum about coming out to her parents. She was like maybe 30, and she was finally going to come out to her parents. And strangers from around the world were supporting her and sending her well wishes and things of this nature. And then the next week when she came back and people were asking her, how did it go? How are you? There's another woman discovered she's pregnant. She and her boyfriend are expecting. They're so excited. Now people who've never met this woman are asking about her pregnancy. You know, it's this kind of thing. It builds a community. And I believe that for a very long time, drag has been a central focus in the LGBT community. As I mentioned, Melissa Ross, and how all of my friends and I would rush to the Cage on Sunday in Cleveland to watch Melissa Ross's show. And as a result, the community sprang up around her. And now, because of social media and the internet, that can happen on a global platform. And I think that it's just such a beautiful thing. I really do. And I'm appreciative of the fact that I get to be part of that.
Yeah. It doesn't make for good radio, but please know that I am smiling ear to ear. Just inspiring stuff, bringing people together, using your talent. I say this to you, Pollo Del Mar, please keep living the dream.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Ken. You as well.
There's a hero. If you look inside your heart, you don't have to be of what you are. There's an answer if you reach into your soul, and the sorrow that you know will melt away. And then a hero comes along with the strength to carry. And you cast your fears aside, and you know you can't survive. So when you feel like hope is gone, look inside you and be strong, and you'll finally see the truth that a hero lies in you.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode to get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. So let's get started. Without question, one of the biggest stories of the week, an appeals court has said that federal law already bans anti-LGB discrimination, lesbian, gay, bisexual discrimination. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which is based in Chicago, has become the first federal appellate court to rule that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 bans discrimination based on sexual orientation. Let's walk through this case. The decision came in the case of Hively versus Ivy Tech Community College. Kimberly Hively was a math instructor at the college, which is located in South Bend, Indiana. She said she was repeatedly denied promotions and ultimately fired after it became known that she was a lesbian. She had been seen kissing her girlfriend in the parking lot at the school. Well, Lambda Legal, representing Hively, argued that discrimination based on sexual orientation is a form of sex discrimination, which is prohibited by Title VII. In this case, they argued that the expectation that people will be heterosexual is a gender stereotype. That's a pretty solid argument. The expectation that people will be heterosexual is a gender stereotype. So discrimination against non-heterosexuals is sex discrimination. Well, this week, a majority of the 11 judges on the Seventh Circuit agreed, which reverses a decision that came last year from a three-judge panel of the circuit. Chief Judge Diane Wood, in the majority decision, it was 8-3, this is what Chief Judge Diane Wood said, quote, "Hively represents the ultimate case of failure to conform to the female stereotype, at least as understood in a place such as modern America, which views heterosexuality as the norm and other forms of sexuality as exceptional. Hively is not heterosexual. Our panel described the line between a gender nonconformity claim and one based on sexual orientation as gossamer thin. We conclude that it does not exist at all. Hively's claim is no different from the claims brought by women who were rejected for jobs in traditionally male workplaces, such as fire departments, construction, and policing. The employers in those cases were policing the boundaries of what jobs or behaviors they found acceptable for a woman, or in some cases, for a man." This is a very, very big deal, listeners. Several federal trial courts and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission have interpreted Title VII in this manner, but the Seventh Circuit, which is a federal appeals court, is the highest court to make the finding, and it sets the precedent for the three states it covers, Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. It remanded this case back to the trial court, which had dismissed her case for rehearing, but it is likely that at some point the issue of whether Title VII covers sexual orientation discrimination will come before the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, a huge, huge deal. Lambda Legal CEO Rachel B. Tiven said this in a press release, quote, "Love won again today. Kim Hively loved her job teaching math at Ivy Tech Community College, but she was fired because she is a lesbian. Today, the Seventh Circuit said clearly, that's wrong. Our movement is about love and pride, pride in yourself and your work, and the freedom to love and be treated equally. Even in these challenging times, Lambda Legal continues to win in court and make our country better." Kim Hively herself said this, quote, "I have been saying all this time that what happened to me wasn't right and was illegal. Now I will have my day in court thanks to this decision. No one should be fired for being lesbian, gay, or transgender like happened to me, and it's incredibly powerful to know that the law now protects me and other LGBT workers." Tons of other people affirming this and celebrating this decision. It really is a big decision. And yes, it does set the stage for the Supreme Court to hear a case whether or not Title VII covers anti-LGBT discrimination, which the Seventh Court of Appeals has said that it does. We will see. Other news out there. In Nevada, a Las Vegas politician is attempting to allow foster children to choose their own gender. A bill has been introduced which would allow children to identify themselves with the gender matching their identity. Bill 99 would also mean training and working with LGBT youth. This week, senators in the state voted 18-2 to pass the bill. They added an amendment meaning children must be protected against rape in correctional facilities. The Las Vegas Division of Children and Family Services would also be required under the bill to set up processes to place LGBTQ children in government care to be more appropriately placed with families. This is a really big deal as well. We are protecting children. We are giving them some agency over their life. This is a good thing. On the other side of the equation, former Trump advisor Roger Stone completely ignored a vile homophobic rant from a TV interviewer who used shocking anti-gay slurs. Mr. Stone, who served as an advisor to the 2016 presidential campaign of Donald Trump, was taking part in a Skype interview with Alex Jones of conspiracy website InfoWars when the incident occurred. The pair were discussing concerns about Stone's ties to Russia, raised by Representative Adam Schiff, co-chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, when Jones set off on a rant. After Stone raised Schiff's irresponsible allegations, Jones seized on the moment to launch into a vile homophobic rant aimed at Schiff, who is in fact married to a woman and has two children. In the rant, which was transcribed by Media Matters, the talk show host fumed, quote, "I'm not against gay people, but Schiff looks like the archetypal," I can't say that word, "with those little deer in the headlight eyes and all his stuff, and there's something about this fairy hopping around, bossing everybody around, trying to intimidate people like me and you," and I'm going to stop reading it right there. Again, the story here is not that this host said all of these horrible things, because this guy is known for saying these horrible things. Alex Jones and his conspiracy website InfoWars, he says horrible things. But you have former Trump advisor Roger Stone, who just sat there. And by the way, I stopped reading. It got so much worse than that. It got so much worse than that. And Stone just sat there, didn't say a word. Let's do some bystander intervention. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But let's keep talking about Trump. Donald Trump has nominated an anti-gay Republican lawmaker as the United States' Secretary of the Army. The irony here being that this new Secretary of the Army replaces the first openly gay man to hold the post. Eric Fanning made history when Barack Obama nominated him as the United States Secretary of the Army in May of last year, making history as the first out man to head a military branch. However, Mr. Fanning was turfed out of his job when Donald Trump took office, with billionaire hockey club owner Vincent Viola serving in the interim role. According to the Tennessean, he nominated Tennessee State Senator Mark Green, a strongly anti-LGBT Republican lawmaker, to fill the full-time role. Green is the author of Tennessee Bill SB 127, which would grant businesses unlimited rights to discriminate without any action from state agencies invalidating any non-discrimination protections. The broadly worded bill states this, quote, "A government entity shall not take discriminatory action against a business entity on the basis of the internal policies of the business entity, including but not limited to personnel and employee benefit policies that are in compliance with state law." When this was introduced, it was attacked by the Human Rights Campaign as a thinly veiled legislative assault on LGBTQ Tennesseans and their families. And now, the end result of the story is that this guy who introduced this bill, yeah, he is now going to be the Secretary of the Army, an anti-gay Republican lawmaker replacing the first openly gay man to hold such a post. So yeah, a little bit of irony there, not a great thing. In the state of Mississippi, arguments are being heard on both sides around a law which would allow anti-LGBT discrimination in Mississippi, because apparently there's another side to this we can argue for such discrimination, and indeed, it's happening in Mississippi. The law, which was halted last July before it could take effect by a federal district judge, would allow merchants and government employees to discriminate if they have religious objections to same-sex marriage. Both sides have expressed confidence after arguments were heard at the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this week in Lubbock, Texas. An attorney for some of the plaintiffs who sued the state, Robert Kaplan, says the law is unconstitutional as it allows specific religious beliefs to trump civil rights. So that is what they are spending their time arguing about in Mississippi. We must, of course, turn our attention to North Carolina, because we have to do so every week, apparently. The mayors of various major U.S. cities have reiterated bans on public-funded travel to North Carolina over their newly repealed HB 2 bathroom ban, saying a deal to repeal it did not go far enough. To remind you, the state last week voted to repeal the HB 2 bathroom law, but they also banned local authorities from outlawing LGBT discrimination. So again, they said, all right, we'll get rid of the bathroom piece, but we are going to tell all these municipalities, don't even try to institute protections. Don't even try to ban non-discrimination in your municipality. We will not allow that right now. LGBT activists have condemned the legislation, which stops local authorities from passing these anti-discrimination laws until December 2020. Activists and campaign groups have also criticized the deal to repeal the bill, saying it doesn't go far enough and only a full repeal will be enough. Well, the mayors and council members of Los Angeles, Santa Fe, Cincinnati, and Salt Lake City all reiterated travel bans on North Carolina. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said this, quote, "Every American deserves to live free of discrimination, and the law signed last week by Governor Cooper does nothing to protect the rights and dignity of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. Cities should have every opportunity to make policies that affirm values of equal justice, protect people from hate and bias, and uphold the constitutional right to self-determination. Until that is made real in North Carolina, I urge the City Council to extend LA's ban on non-essential travel to the state by city employees. I would sign that ban right away and will continue doing everything in my power to make sure that Los Angeles tax dollars are never spent to support bigotry based on sexual orientation and gender identity." Again, that was Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez said this, quote, "Cities are closer to the people they serve than any other form of government, giving us both the ability and the duty to hear and take real action on their concerns, especially when they involve safety. In Santa Fe, we stood up to ensure that every individual, regardless of their gender identity, will feel safe here. North Carolina shouldn't stand in the way of their cities who want to do the same, and until they make it right, we have no intention of changing the ban on non-essential travel. That is our current policy." And one more quote. This is Cincinnati City Council member Chris Seelbach. He tweeted this, quote, "North Carolina's, quote, repeal of HB2 is not a repeal, just a renaming of the same bad law. Cincinnati will continue to boycott." So they tried something there in North Carolina, but it stopped way, way short of what they needed to do. And again, these municipalities in North Carolina, they cannot make progress on non-discrimination laws until 2020. That is not good. It's not good. Hey, a new study has found that 1 in 5 millennials identifies as LGBTQ. A Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation survey, their Accelerating Acceptance 2017 survey of more than 2,000 people in the U.S., found that 20% of adults under 35 years of age identified as LGBTQ. It also found that 12% of respondents said they did not identify with their sex assigned at birth or otherwise don't conform to gender stereotypes. The latest survey comes in contrast to one conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute, which found that 7% of adults under 35 identified as LGBTQ. So this is definitely something to keep an eye on. I know I ranted last week and a couple of you wrote in, which I loved. And you can always write in ken@thisshowisogay.com. I respond to every single email. So anything that you hear on this show or any guest that you ever want, write in. And some people hilariously wrote in and said that I went on a rant, which I did last week, because the fact that we will no longer be collecting sexual orientation, gender identity markers in the 2020 census is more than a bit problematic. We can't discover information like this, you know, finding out how many millennials identify as LGBTQ, if we're not asking these questions. And then if we're not asking these questions and we're not collecting this data, well, then we can't design programs to support our community. So yes, we have to collect more data. These studies will come out and they will help us determine which directions we should go. Sarah Kate Ellis, the president of GLAAD, said this, quote, "The study shows a remarkable new era of understanding and acceptance among young people, an inspiring indication of the future. As the U.S. administration begins to fulfill its pledges to move the country backwards, many are concerned about progress made in recent years for the LGBTQ community. Though laws can be unwritten, hearts and minds in America have been changed of the better, and that is a reality less easily unraveled." That's Sarah Kate Ellis, the president of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. It's fun to cover every now and then things Pat Robertson is saying, because he says such nutty things. Well, TV evangelist Pat Robertson, he's upset yet again about homosexuals. He's upset. He's 87 years old. He's not happy. He's the host of the nationally syndicated Christian Broadcasting Network show, The 700 Club, which airs on Disney ABC channel Freeform. Well, he simply loves putting his overactive imagination to use talking about gay people, and his latest non sequitur, well, he said quite a bit. This is what he said, quote, "When you get down to it, Christians are still the majority in this country, but we have given the ground to a small minority. You figure lesbians, 1% of the population, which is not true, homosexuals, 2% of the population, which is not true. That's all. That's statistically all. But they have dominated the media. They've dominated the cultural shift, and they have infiltrated the major universities. It's just unbelievable what's being done. A tiny, tiny minority makes a huge difference. The majority, it's time to wake up." That's Pat Robertson, who is citing some statistically unsound research. I don't even know that he's citing anything. I think he's just making up stats, because no, lesbians are not 1% of the population. They're more than that. And homosexuals are not 2% of the population. They're more than that. But it's funny that he then says, that's all, that's statistically all. I just want to take this opportunity to remind people, that's actually not statistics. That's not how statistics work, you know, at all. So that's Pat Robertson being a little bit nutty. And another fun story, an anti-LGBT conservative legal group is claiming that religious care homes in California will be forced to operate homosexual brothels. Who knew? Homosexual brothels for elderly pensioners if discrimination protections are put in place. This claim comes from the Pacific Justice Institute. I love when they have justice in the title. It implies that they are going to be somewhat about justice, which, you know, they're not. Well, the Pacific Justice Institute is lobbying against a California bill to protect LGBT care home residents. The Democrat-backed LGBT care home residents bill would include explicit discrimination protections for elderly residents on the basis of a person's sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, or HIV status. But the Pacific Justice Institute claims it would lead to the nuns caring for the elderly and disabled being forced to run bordellos from their Catholic care homes. In a letter to the bill's authors, they claim this, quote, "For religiously conservative facilities, this brings issues related to sexual intimacy and biology. SB 219 prevents a facility from restricting a resident's right to sexual intimacy, which includes receiving visitors." And they go on to say that, yes, this would basically compel nuns to set up bordellos. Why do we cover these stories? Because it's important to know that this is what people are putting out there. We cannot form arguments unless we understand how other people are spending their time and money, and it's to say ridiculous things like that. There was one last story where there's a group who's urging the Defense Secretary of the United States to overturn the appointment of a Air Force chief because she's a lesbian, and they wrote this whole letter that implies, not just implies, but flat out says she's ungodly. She couldn't possibly head the U.S. Air Force Academy because she's a lesbian and is therefore ungodly. These arguments still exist, and we can't just turn a blind eye to them. We need to know that this is how people spend their time, this is how people spend their money, and this is how people use their voice. And then we can construct effective counterarguments. That's how that works. That's it for this week's episode. Our thanks, of course, to Pollo Del Mar. She is doing incredible things out in California. I urge you to listen to her podcast, Party Foul Radio. It is so much fun. It is so much fun. And of course, if you've not done so yet, stroll on over to Amazon, type in Ken Schneck, K-E-N. S-C-H-N-E-C-K, and you can buy my book, pre-order it right now. It's discounted on Amazon right this very second. It's doing very well. It's very exciting. The book is called Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew, available in paperback and hardcover right this very second on Amazon. Pretty soon, it will be available in audiobook, because you're used to hearing my voice, and that audiobook is all recorded. And for you technologically capable people, yes, of course. It will be an ebook as well. That's all coming out on May 23rd, but you can pre-order it on Amazon right this very second. In the meantime, after you pre-order my book, after you listen to Party Foul Radio with Pollo Del Mar, you guys get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay.